Very good, responded Judah softly. Here is nobody who spiteth thee on account of thy fear, Reuben, son of thy mother. For likewise it is brave to confess thy fear. And if thou thinkest we are blithe and gay round heart and kidneys, and know naught of the fear of Jacob, then thou mistakest. But what good is it to regret what has happened, and what avail to boggle at the inevitable? Joseph is out of the world, and this coat witnesseth the truth. A sign is milder than words. Therefore we shall bring the sign before Jacob, and are dispensed of words. Must we then, asked Asher, Zilpah's son, and licked his lips after his habit, must we then, since we speak of carrying the robe, all of us at once bring the sign to Jacob, and all of us be there when he interpreteth it? Rather, let one go delicately ahead with the garment and bring it to him. But we others come afterwards, and get there only when he hath already interpreted it to himself. It seemeth to me milder so. I propose Naphtali, the runner, for bearer and messenger. Or let us draw lots to see who shall bear it. Draw lots, cried Naphtali in haste. I am for drawing lots, for I too imagine the future when I speak of it, and I freely confess my fear. Listen, men, said Dan. Now I will be the judge and free you all. For from me cometh the plan, and I can shape it in my mind like wet earth and potter's clay. I will improve it, for we shall not bring Jacob the robe, neither one nor all of us. To strangers will we give it, somebody whom we shall hire, people of the place and the neighborhood, receptive to good words and a little wool and a few curds. We will impress on him what he shall say to Jacob, thus and thus, and this found we in the field near Dothan, and came upon it in the desert by chance. Look at it closer, Father and Lord, whether it is not indeed the garment of thy son. Thus shall they speak, and when they have said, let them go away. But we will tarry a few days before we follow, until he has fully interpreted to himself the sign, and knows that he has lost one, and gained ten. Are ye satisfied? It is well, they said, or at least is worth talking about. Therefore let us accept it, for anything that is a practical plan, in a case like this, must be considered good. They all accepted it, even Reuben, although he had laughed bitterly when Dan spoke of ten whom Jacob was winning for one. But they kept on sitting before the huts under the stars, and continued to take counsel, for they were somewhat uncertain of each other. The nine looked at Reuben, who had obviously intended to steal the lad and cheat them, and they were afraid before him. But he looked at the nine, who had remained so strangely unmoved at the news that the pit was empty, and did not know what he should think. A frightful oath, said Levi, rude but pious, who liked to arrange religious ceremonies and had knowledge of them. We must swear a frightful oath, that none of us ever tell Jacob or anyone a single little word of what hath happened here, and what we did with the dreamer, not by a sign or a flicker of an eyelash, so long as he shall live. Thou sayest it, that we must, agreed Asher, and this oath must bind us ten together, and make us into a league, so that we are like one body and one silence, as though we were not single persons, one here and one there, but one man, who presseth his lips together, and openeth them not, even in death, but dieth, his mouth shut together over his secret. One can stifle and slay an event by silence, which one rolleth over it like a stone. Then the breath goeth out of it for lack of air and light, and the event ceaseth to have happened. Believe me, so dieth much that has happened, if the silence over it is unbroken. For without the breath of words can not exist. We must keep silence as one man. Then will this story be as it had not been, and thereto Levi's frightful oath may help us, for it shall make us a bond. They agreed to this, no one of them being willing to rely upon himself for his silence, but preferring to share in a mighty common bond, which should shelter him from his weakness. Therefore Levi, Leah's son, devised frightful formulas for the oath. They drew so close together that their noses rubbed and their breath mingled, put their hands in a pile, and with one voice called on the highest, El Elyon, God of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob. Neither did they forget the several Baals of the land, known unto them, Anu of Uruk, Elil of Nippur, and Bel Haran, Sin the moon, but named them as compurgators, and swore with one voice, mouth almost on mouth, that he who did not keep silence about it, or who did even with nod, wink, or sign betray it, or glance at it, such a one should turn whore, and the daughter of sin, mistress of womankind, should take from him the bow, that is his manhood, that he should be like a mule, but more rightly said, a whore who took her hire upon the street. One land should drive him into the other, so that he should not know where to lay his whorish head, and should neither live nor die, but life and death should spit him to one another in disgust his life long. Thus the oath. When they had sworn it, they were easier and steadier, for this was a mighty insurance. But when they broke up the council and went each one to his sleep, one said to another, it was Issachar said it to Zebulun, I have an envy, and my envy is of Tutura, the little one, Benjamin, our youngest at home, for that he knoweth nothing of all this, and remaineth outside this matter and this oath. He is fortunate, and I envy him. Thou too? I too, indeed, answered Zebulun. But Reuben, for his part, was trying to remember the words of the irritating youth of the place, who had sat on the wellstone. It was not easy to remember them, for they had been vague and full of twilight, more idle than real words, and hard to reproduce. Yet in Reuben's deepest understanding, a seed did remain behind, which knew naught of itself, as the seed of life knoweth naught of itself in the body of the mother, but the mother knoweth of it. It was the seed of expectation which Reuben cherished, and nourished it secretly, sleeping and waking, till he was a gray-haired man, through as many years as Jacob had served for the devil Laban. Chapter 7. He Who Was Mangled. Jacob mourns for Joseph. Is a sign more merciful than words? That is a moot question. Judah argued from the point of view of the bringer of bad tidings, who prefers the sign because it saves him the trouble of words. But for him who receives it, in the strength of his ignorance, he can put the word aside. He can tread it underfoot as a lie and an abominable fabrication, and consign it to perdition as unutterable rubbish. He can roar with laughter born of solid conviction before it dawns on the poor wretch that the matter is not to be got rid of that way. The word penetrates but slowly. At first it is incredible, its sense not to be grasped or realized. You are still free to remain in your ignorance by retorting upon the messenger the confusion which his message would set up in your own heart and brain, and to denounce him roundly as wrong in the head. What is that you say? You may ask him. Are you not well? Come, let me look after you. Have a little something to drink. Then you will feel better and talk at least so that a body can take in what you say. It is not very pleasant for the messenger, but he pities you and knows himself master of the situation. He is kind, and slowly his look of mingled reason and compassion casts doubt into your soul. You cannot sustain that look. You understand that it is impossible to hold to that allocation of roles to which you cling as a means of self-preservation, and at length you perceive that it is you who need to take a little drink from him. It is the word which permits of this slow, rear-guard action against the forces of truth. With a sign, nothing of the sort is possible. No temporizing fiction avails against its heaped-up cruelty. It is unmistakable. It does not need to be realized, because it is real. It is palpable. It scorns to spare by being only gradually effective. It leaves no possible way of escape. It forces you to conceive in your own head the idea which, if presented in words, you would brush aside as madness. It drives you to the conclusion that either you are mad or it is true. Directness and indirectness are differently mingled in the word and the sign. It is hard to tell which is the more brutally immediate. The sign is mute, not out of gentleness, however, but only because it needs not to speak to be understood, being the thing itself. Without a word, it lays you low. And Jacob truly, according to all expectation, was, at the sight of the coat of many colors, stricken to the earth. This is an assured fact, but nobody saw just what happened, for the two wretched men of Dothan, who had undertaken, in consideration of a fixed amount of wool and curds, to play the role of finders, had taken to their heels as soon as they had made their little speech, not waiting to see what would be its effect. They gave the blood-stiffened rags into the hands of Jacob, the man of God, and left him standing there before his tent of skins. They slunk away, first taking very long steps, and then bursting into a run as they got farther off. No one knows how long he stood there, looking down at that little, which, as his understanding slowly forced him to comprehend, was all there was left in the world of Joseph. Then, indeed, he had fallen. And women passing came and found him lying there. The wives of his sons they were, the Shechemite Bunah, Simeon's spouse, also Levi's, the so-called grandchild of Eber. These lifted him in alarm and brought him within his tent. They knew at once from what he held in his hands the cause of his attack. It was no common faint in which he lay, but a sort of rigor that gripped every muscle and fiber of his body, turning it to stone, so that one could not bend a joint without breaking it. It is a rare phenomenon, but does sometimes occur, as a reaction to some extraordinary stress. It is like a spasm of resistance, a desperate, defiant insensibility called up to meet something which the system cannot bear. It will last some hours, slowly capitulating before the relentless onslaught of reality and suffering, against which there is no help. Men servants and women servants, surrounding him on all sides, watched fearfully the spectacle of this pillar of salt slowly melting before their eyes into the limp receptivity of abject suffering. He had still no voice, and could only whisper his answer, as it were his admission, to the long-since-departed messengers, "Yes, it is my son's coat." But then suddenly he cried out in a voice which rose to a shriek under the spur of his despair, "A beast of prey hath preyed upon Joseph! An evil beast hath rent him in pieces!" And as though his own words put him in mind of what was now to be done, he began tearing his clothes. It was high summer, his clothing was light and offered little resistance. He put all his strength into the work, but it took some time, because of the uncannily silent thoroughness with which he did it. The onlookers saw with horror, and with futile gestures designed to prevent the extravagance, that he did not stop at the upper garment, as they expected. No. He went on, apparently of fell design, to strip off every rag he had on, throw the several pieces from him, and stand there stark naked. Considering the known delicacy of the man's feelings, that aversion to exposure of the flesh which everybody respected in him, the sight was so unnatural and debasing that nobody could bear it. With one accord, wailing and protesting, the onlookers turned away and went hence. There is only one right and proper word for the feeling which was at the bottom of their action. Shame. But one must understand it in its ultimate and often forgotten sense, as a monosyllabic description of the horror we feel when the primitive breaks through the layers of civilization, at the surface of which it is only active in a much softened and allegorical form. We must regard the tearing of the upper garments in heavy sorrow as being of such a nature. It is the civilized and domesticated form of the original or primitive custom of shedding all the clothes, shedding every covering and adornment considered as the badge of human dignity now destroyed and ruined by the extremity of human woe. It is the abasement of man to mere creature. So it was with Jacob. In the depth of his grief, he went back to the original meaning, from the allegory to the crude thing itself and to the horrible reality. He did what one does not do, and that, rightly considered, is the source of all horror, for therein the undermost comes uppermost. If, for instance, it had occurred to him to give utterance to the abandonment of his misery by bleating like a ram, his people could not have felt more nauseated than they did. They fled then out of shame, but we may question whether they so best served the pathetic old man, whether he was not gratifying his deepest desire in this crass exhibition of utter woe, and whether it was quite so gratifying to him to be left alone with it. He was not, however, actually alone, for what he did needed no human witness to serve its end and aim, which was to stir up feelings of horror. At whom, or to be exact, against whom, his action was directed? In whom it was designed to stir up feelings of horror? Before whose eyes he was trying to bring this manifestation of a return to the original state of nature? All this the desperate father knew only too well. His people came to know it too, especially Eliezer, Abraham's oldest servant. He took particular interest in it, that strange institution of an old man who knew how to use the first person singular in so truly singular a way, and to meet whom the earth had advanced by bounds. He, too, was pierced to the heart by the sight of the token and by the frightful news that Joseph, his lovely and so intelligent pupil, had fallen victim to a mischance on his journey and been made the prey of a ravening beast. But his curiously impersonal character, his peculiarly extensive consciousness of his own individuality, enabled him to receive the blow with a certain composure. Also, his natural concern for Jacob, the man of sorrows, left him small leisure to dwell upon his own pain. It was Eliezer who brought food to Jacob, though the latter refused for days to touch it, who enforced him to seek his couch by night, and then did not stir from beside it. By day, Jacob had taken up his station on a heap of potsherds and ashes in a remote and shadeless corner of the settlement. There he sat, naked, with the pieces of the coat in his hands, his hair, beard, and shoulders strewn with ashes. From time to time he scraped himself with a potsherd from the heap, in token that he was afflicted with sores and boils, all of which was purely symbolic behavior, for he had none, and the scraping was part of the demonstration directed to the same address as the rest. Certainly the sight of this pitiful figure, so absorbed in its penance, was touching enough, even without the symbolic representation of impurity. Everybody, save the eldest servant, avoided in awe and embarrassment the scene of this exposure. Jacob's body was no longer that of the slender yet sturdy young man who had wrestled undefeated with the ox-eyed stranger by Jabbok Ford and lived out that windy night with the unchosen bride, nor was it that of him who late begot Joseph upon the true wife. Some 70 years, not precisely counted and reckoned, but counting to good effect in the objective sense, had since passed over his head and marked him with the touching, if unattractive, misshapenness of old age. And this it was that made his naked state so painful to see. Youth displays itself freely and joyously, with a good conscience based on its own beauty. Age shrouds itself in modesty and dignity, and well knows why. This breast, with its growth of white hairs on a skin reddened by the sun, and its shape, as a man's does in age, approaching to a woman's, these nerveless arms and spent thighs, the folds of the relaxed abdomen, all this was no sight for anybody save old Eliezer, who took it with composure and made no objection. So little-minded was he to put obstacles in the way of his master's demonstration. He was even less likely to prevent Jacob in the performance of the other rites, which did not go beyond what was customary in heavy sorrow, particularly the sojourn on the dust-heap, the repeated sprinkling of ashes, which then mingled with his sweat and his tears. These were only proper. Eliezer was merely concerned to erect a temporary shelter over the place of penance, that the son of Tammuz might not turn the penance into torture. Even in its shade, Jacob's woebegone face was suffused with bright crimson from the heat and his affliction. His jaw hung down, his eyes rolled upwards ever and anon out of the unfathomable deeps of his suffering. And he remarked all this himself, as soft and self-examining natures do, being concerned with their own condition and convinced that it receives too little notice by going unmentioned.